Following Dharma Talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the evening practice group once again. My name is Gail Iverson, and I'm filling in for Mark Nunberg. He's, probably as most of you know, he's doing a month-long retreat in Massachusetts, and he's going to be back on June 2nd. So some guest teachers are filling in for him while he's gone. About a month ago, when he asked me to give him a title for this talk, I was thinking about what I would like to talk about, and I just finished taking a Buddha studies class here. And it was on the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And so one of the things that, phrases that Mark had used in that class was the phrase of welcoming things as they are. And I like that phrase. And it just struck me as something that would be useful to work with. So it's quite challenging for human beings to just welcome things the way they are. We tend to prefer what is pleasant and to not like what is unpleasant. And so we push and pull on those experiences, those feelings when they arise. But in this practice, we practicing mindfulness, which is this non-judgmental attitude to our experience. So I'd just like to share with you some words that the Buddha spoke about kind of a radical welcoming of the way things are. These are some instructions that he gave to his son Rahula. And his son came to him and asked him for his inheritance at one point. And so the Buddha gave him the, what was called the going forth, or ordained him as a monk. And at some point, these are some instructions that he gave to him. Practice like the earth, Rahula. If you become like the earth, then the sensations which arise, whether pleasant or unpleasant, do not take hold of the mind, nor do they establish themselves. People may pour clean things onto the earth, or dirty things such as feces, urine, saliva, pus, blood, but the earth is not hurt, nor is it angered or moved to disgust. So too, if you practice like the earth, Rahula, then sensations which arise, whether pleasant or unpleasant, cannot take hold of the mind, nor will they establish themselves. Practice like water, Rahula. If you become like water, then the sensations which arise, whether pleasant or unpleasant, do not take hold of the mind, nor do they establish themselves. People may wash clean things with water or dirty things, such as pus and so on, but the water is not hurt, nor is it angered or moved to disgust. So too, if you practice like water, Rahula, then sensations which arise, whether pleasant or unpleasant, cannot take hold of the mind, nor will they establish themselves. So that's pretty radical. What would it be like to not react with hurt, anger, or disgust towards unpleasant things that happen to us? We could add many other states of mind to this hurt, anger, disgust. Could add not reacting to sensual desire, dullness, sleepiness, worry, restlessness, regret, resentment, doubt. These are often listed as obstacles to meditation practice, and when our minds get caught up and distracted into thinking, it's usually one of these mind states that we are distracted into. Of course, these states naturally arise in the mind. Until we become liberated, we can't keep them from occurring, but we can change our relationship to them by noticing them and when they arise, and by cultivating a habit of welcoming them. So tonight I'd like to focus on a particular state of mind, worry and restlessness. So this is quite a popular state of mind with many human beings. Very much we like to plan things, and then we like to plan some more and worry about them if the plans are going to meet our expectations, or if we've made the right decision, or oftentimes it's just kind of an automatic pilot. The mind keeps worrying about things and wrestling with them. A few years ago, my sister, who meditates in another tradition, she organized a monastic visit with her group, and they rented a center for them to have the gathering at, and just all kinds of things went wrong. There were problems with the center had a minimum, and there were problems. There wasn't as much interest as they thought there was going to be, and they were really concerned that they weren't going to have enough money to cover the expenses, or she was at any rate. But she was kind of in charge of it, and so she had quite a bit of worry that was going on around this whole process. But eventually the event did occur, and it was fine, but she was talking to one of the monks who had come, and she was describing to him the things that she had gone through and how she could work with these in a better way in the future, because it had really been kind of difficult for her. And he told her to eliminate worry from her consciousness. And now I don't know, that phrase really stuck with me. Now I don't know if he himself had eliminated worry from his consciousness. Perhaps he had, but he definitely believed and had faith and trust that it was possible for an ordinary human being. Not that my sister's that ordinary, but but for an ordinary human being to be able to eliminate worry. Now, we know that worry never helps. We know that very clearly. We've seen that over and over again, that it's just, but for somehow there's some kind of a deep belief in the mind that this is a necessary activity for us to participate in. One of the things that I've had some confusion with, and I've heard others talk about it, especially with the practice where we talk about being mindful, being aware of our moment-to-moment experience, being in the present moment, then how does that relate to planning? Does that mean that as human beings we have to give up planning? And when I was preparing for this talk this evening, I listened to a talk on dharmaseed.org that was given by a meditation teacher. Perhaps you've heard of her. Her name is Narayan Grady Levinson. Levinson Grady, excuse me. And during the talk, she shared a story that I really thought was kind of fun. She said that they had given a 8-week meditation course. She teaches in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they had given an 8-week meditation course. And there had been a gentleman who came every week to the class and was very enthusiastic about the meditation practice. And whenever they had a discussion, he always said how delighted he was to be learning these principles and to be learning how to meditate, and how helpful he had found it in his life. I was just very happy that he was able to take this class. And then on the last night, they had a little circle to end the class, and they were going around and people were sharing about what they had learned. And he said, well, you know, as you know, I've been very happy taking this class. I wanted to be very beneficial, but I have to quit doing this practice. I can't do this meditation practice because you're always talking about how we have to be in the present moment, and I'm a city planner. And so I have to quit my job in order to do this practice, and I'm just not prepared to make that kind of a change. So it was explained to him that it was possible to plan in a mindful way, to bring the activity of planning, to use that as an activity to practice mindfulness. And indeed, that this is a possibility for us. When we decided to look for a new home for Common Ground Meditation Center several years ago now, there was a lot of planning that was necessary in order to make that a possibility. So we had to look for a building, and then there was, that was a whole process of planning and looking, getting input from the community, and making decisions about what would be the best for this community. And then once having found a building and decided upon it, which was quite another bit of planning that went into that, then the planning for remodeling it and raising the funds to finance it. And it was just much planning that went on. And there was really an effort during that whole process, all of the people who were involved, to really make it a part of practice. And of course, there were times when that was difficult, when things did not seem clear, but there really was that strong intention. And I think when there's that strong intention in our planning and our efforts to make plans, that the likelihood of, if we're skillful in the process of planning, then it's more likely that the outcome will be beneficial also. Now, of course, part of this process of planning is to keep in mind that all of the things that we don't have control over, and that this is just a plan, just something that we would like to see come to fruition, but to really keep in mind that, of course, we don't control the future. We can't. We can only plan, and then whatever comes, then we can be willing to be open to welcoming that, whatever that may be. Because it's, even though things unfold lawfully, that whole process of unfolding is so complicated that as human beings we can't possibly understand that whole process. So, but what we can do is we can be aware as much as possible, and we can be welcoming as much as possible. Those are the tenets of mindfulness practice. Now, it's oftentimes when we're sitting in meditation, sometimes the first insight, it's kind of common first insight that people have, is how busy the mind is and how much of that busyness is around worry and planning. So this is a good thing for us to know, to be aware of this. And then, so what are we going to do about it? Well, it's not so good for us to stop our meditation period and to start writing down our plans. it's better for us to notice that, that there's something that's coming up. Oftentimes there'll be some situation that will kind of be coming up over and over again, and we can take note of that, and then later we can reflect and we can decide if this is something that we actually need to plan for. And then we can set aside some time so that we can actually sit down and write down our ideas about, you know, what would be, you know, what we feel would be a good, you know, good options, a good scenario for us to follow. So the first thing is that we make this conscious choice. Most of the time we're not making a conscious choice about planning. It's just an automatic pilot. And we really kind of get into believing that, you know, all of this planning is like a really necessary thing for us to do. So we can, you know, actually plan to plan, make a choice about planning. Sometimes there are things that we are avoiding or procrastinating about, and these will often kind of keep bubbling up in our meditation practice. So, and it's good to, you know, the meditation practice isn't an escape from life. It's a way to have a better relationship with life, and to, so avoiding and procrastinating isn't a better, no, a way, a good way of relating. So, especially if we're doing that, it's good to make a decision to turn towards those problems. That's kind of what we're doing in the meditation practice all along, is we have a habit of turning away from whatever's unpleasant, and now we're deciding to have a new relationship to the unpleasant, and we're going to, as much as we can, we're going to turn towards it and open up to it. And that's a much more skillful and beneficial activity for human beings to participate in. And so we can have a perspective on our need to make a decision. Is this something that is important? Sometimes, you know, we can ask ourselves the question, how important is this? If it's not so important, we don't have to give it a lot of energy necessarily. But sometimes there are major decisions that we need to make. And then oftentimes what happens is, even if we consciously choose and sit down to plan, there will be maybe several options that will arise, and we'll have a hard time kind of knowing. Maybe some at one point, you know, one option will seem really good, and then something comes in, and, you know, we take a look and, oh, maybe this option is better. And, you know, there could be a number of possibilities that will come up, and sometimes there can be a lot of confusion that will come along with, you know, with what decision is, you know, the best one in this situation. So one of the ways that I've heard people talk about this is to just kind of let the mind, when we're, you know, working on these major decisions, see if we can just kind of let those scenarios just kind of run, rather than trying to stop them or trying to make one, you know, better than the other. And, you know, Sylvia Boorstein had a suggestion that she uses when there are things that are going on in her mind that she's confused about. She says that she listens to those voices as though they were neighbors talking on the other side of the fence. So it's kind of like she imagines, instead of, you know, like being so identified with the voices, she kind of gives them a little space by imagining that they are neighbors that she's listening to that are talking on the other side of the fence, and she doesn't really have to be that involved in their discussion or conversation. It's just kind of running in the background, and she can let it run and then see what happens. Often, usually these things, if we don't give them energy, they naturally stop of their own. So once we've made a decision, it's good to stick to it. Then we can have it, make a decision to stop the planning process, and we can see, of course, the there will be probably the desire to take it up again. We're still not quite sure, but we can just notice that. So in this part of, in the first part of the process, we're kind of consciously making the decision to turn towards it and to involve ourselves in the planning activity. Now we're doing the other thing. We've made the decision. Now we're doing the process of letting go, letting go, letting go when those things come up. So sometimes instead of planning and worrying about the future, sometimes there also comes up regrets about the past. So this is sort of the same sort of state of mind, the worrying about the future, the regretting the past. Regret and resentments often are also things that that come up. And of course, we notice those, and we can turn towards them, open up to them as best we can. But sometimes there are things that need our attention. We need to make some action around those regrets. And so again, if that's something that's coming up, it's helpful to take some time, to set aside some time to reflect on, and it's especially helpful to write down, maybe just kind of do a review of our past behavior and look at what regrets are there. And then it's not like this thing where we're flagellating ourselves or beating ourselves up for this bad behavior or bad decisions that we've made in the past. It's we bring to this reflection on these regrets or resentments, we bring a very matter-of-fact attitude towards them. And we're just making a list and taking a look at that. And then it's really helpful if we have someone who we can share them with, either if we have a spiritual teacher or a good friend who we feel will not be judgmental about our sharing these. It's a good way, saying them out loud is a really helpful way to let go of them. And then we can see if there's anything that we need to do beyond that. Is there some, we've been looking, perhaps in the future, we just will, having looked at this, that these are not skillful behaviors, these are not things that we would like to repeat. So we can make some decisions about possibly changing our behavior, or maybe we need to apologize to someone. We can make those decisions once we're clear about what our regrets are. It's a common thing in Buddhist monasteries for people to do this practice. And so oftentimes, like once a week, the monks and nuns will have a formal time where they review their behavior, and they express whatever regrets that they have about that, and ask for forgiveness. So that can be a really powerful practice. I spent 3 months one time at the Bhavana Society in West Virginia. It's a meditation center and monastery that was founded by Bhante Gunaratana. Perhaps some of you have read his book, Mindfulness in Plain English, and 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness, and I know he's recently written another book as well. And he's a Sri Lankan monk. He's been practicing for, I think, over 50 years. And he's quite an impressive human being. But anyway, part of the, that there was this forgiveness practice that was done there. And at the end of the sitting every night, there would be an opportunity for people to express any regrets that they had and for ask forgiveness for that. It's really quite lovely. And actually, a friend of mine, I was there with a friend of mine, and he had a little altercation one day in the kitchen with one of the nuns. And after he came back home, he received a letter from her apologizing for that. And I thought that, I don't know, I was really quite touched by that willingness to forgive and to ask for forgiveness. So these are some things that we can do to help to calm the mind, help the mind to be more calm and balanced, more easily focused when we sit down to meditate. If we've taken care of what we need to take care of in terms of planning and in terms of regrets, then oftentimes it's easier for the mind to be focused. Of course, it's not so good to substitute these activities for the seated quiet meditation practice. These are things that just that will help to enhance that. So if we have a choice, I think probably the better option would be to choose to sit with it. But just something to reflect on. So just a few words about when we sit down and when sitting in meditation practice, how we can work with the worry and the planning mind. Of course, the first thing that we can always do is just to notice it and name it. That's a very powerful practice, just to bring it to our awareness. This is one of the, when the Buddha taught about meditation practice, there are two suttas that are widely taught in, especially in the Western tradition that, where I've been mostly taught, and that is the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the sutta on breathing in and breathing out. It gives very detailed meditation instructions. And the other one is the Satipatthana Sutta. And that is the four foundations of mindfulness. So it's being mindful of the body and the feelings, the mind, and the objects of the mind. So I'd like to just take a moment to read the first part of the instructions from the Anapanasati Sutta. So, listen, practitioners, anapanasati that one has developed and made much of naturally has great fruits and great benefits. Practitioners, anapanasati that one has developed and made much of perfects the four applications of mindfulness. The four applications of mindfulness that one has developed and made much of perfect the seven factors of awakening. The seven factors of awakening that one has developed and made much of perfect knowledge and liberation. Practitioners, how is anapanasati developed and made much of so that there are great fruits and great benefits? A practitioner in this training goes into the forest or to the base of a tree, to an empty dwelling, sits cross-legged with body upright and securely established mindfulness. The meditator is ever mindful, breathing in and mindful, breathing out. When breathing in, one thoroughly understands, I am breathing in long. When breathing in long, one thoroughly understands, I am breathing in long. When breathing out long, one thoroughly understands, I am breathing out long. When breathing in short, one thoroughly understands, I am breathing in short. When breathing out short, one thoroughly understands, I am breathing out short. So the instructions are very simple, just to be aware. Is the breath long? Is the breath short? But in order to do that, we have to pay attention all along the process of the breath so that we know if it is a long breath or a short breath. So how can we apply these kind of instructions to the mind state of worry? First of all, we'll draw our attention, we'll become aware that there's a pattern of thinking that's arising in the mind, and we can identify that pattern of thinking as worrying or planning. Sometimes there's kind of the what-if scenario. There's the anxiety, there's fear of perhaps what's going to happen in the future. That's kind of one form of worry. Sometimes, though, there's another form of, so it's related to worry, is fantasizing. We can be thinking about very pleasant things that might happen, that we'd like to happen in the future, and we can get very caught up and attached in those. So we can take a look and see the kind of the flavor of the worry or the restlessness. And then once we identified it, then we can notice if the feelings that are associated with that, are they pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? We can ask ourselves that question. And not to make an assumption, but because that's usually what we do. We usually assume. But to actually, in the moment, to recognize and to recognize what is unpleasantness? What is that feeling of unpleasantness in the mind and in the body? Really, there's many teachers use all kinds of different words for that process. Mark often uses the term become intimate with. Sometimes it's make friends with. I've heard love it to death. what I'm talking about tonight, welcome it. It's another way of turning towards that. And then we can also notice, in addition to the whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, we can notice if there's resistance or attachment to it. Is there, sometimes it's very obvious. Sometimes the resistance is very obvious, and then we're really caught there, and we're really held there. And that's a good time for us really to notice that. What is that like? We don't want to notice it, but we can, and it's important because all of these things do end. And that's a very important lesson for the mind to see over and over again, is that these states, when we're in them, even though we intellectually know it, there's some feeling in the mind that this is like, we're going to be in this hell forever. And we know it never lasts. But to actually see that, for the mind to actually see that, is really beneficial thing for us to do. So that's basically the three ways that we can bring a deeper investigation to the state of worry when we're sitting on the cushion. Just knowing, first of all, recognizing that pattern, then we can notice the pleasantness, the unpleasantness, neutrality of it, and then we can notice our resistance to it, our reaction to it, and that can just be a very beneficial way for us to practice. So I'd just like to finish up here with this is a poem that I wrote a while ago. I was sitting at my desk and I looked out the window and I saw a cardinal sitting on a tree, and it was snowing. And so it's called, entitled Through the Window. On the branch of the dead mountain ash, a cardinal sits. No thoughts of tomorrow, no regrets for yesterday, just sitting in the silence of falling snow. So we have a few minutes left now, and I'd like to just ask if anyone would like to share anything that they've noticed about worrying and planning, any way they've worked with it, or are working with it, any challenges that you've found, or any successes that you've found, or any questions? Yes?
I just took the 6-week course. Well, it's the second time I took it after 7 years. First time, I don't think I got the morning voice. So a lot of my practice now is what you said, you mentioned, and you were talking about the worry things thing. And I forget the exact words you used for, but I usually think in terms of attraction or aversion. Maybe to the situation I'm worried about. A lot of my practices, what I'm trying to do, sometimes when I'm sitting, is when the four pillars, either the way my mind feels or my emotions or the thought process, is to not feed aversion or attraction, or just take a neutral stance on all these things. So it seems like that's been going pretty well, but I wonder if you could kind of elaborate on that, how you do that, or is that the proper practice, is to kind of back off whenever I sense the aversion or attraction?
Well, it's really good that you've noticed that, that there is the attraction or the aversion is present. And then, we want to the best of our ability, to open up. So it kind of depends. Sometimes we want to get a little space. Kind of like I talked about, listening to the neighbors talking over the fence. Sometimes it's good if there's a, if there's a kind of a strong reaction, or it's something that we just learn over time, then we can, we don't want to ever push anything away, but we can, I think you said you used like having a more neutral attitude, or I use the word matter of fact. Having that kind of matter of fact attitude towards it. And to be as present with it as we can, moment by moment, and to see what happens with it. how long does it last? And to have a willingness for it to last as long or as short as it wants. It is our feeding of it that keeps those states going. So even a little bit of aversion or a little bit of attraction gives them energy, gives those states energy. So sometimes we, you know, we can, as I said, there's other words that are used, like this idea of being intimate. Sometimes we can, you know, just like kind of delve into that. We don't want to be, you know, kind of like tensing up around it or, you know, pushing it away. So, you know, there is, it's just this kind of balance. So we're looking to always balance the factors of being alert to it, being clear about it, and being relaxed about it. Most of the time, if we're clear about something, we're not so relaxed usually. You know, if there's a state that we have aversion to, if there's clarity about it, we're usually tend to have tension around it. If there is, so then we want to have more, we want to see if we can bring in more of the relaxed quality. But oftentimes when something will come up, then we'll get the relaxed quality of, you know, sleepiness, drowsiness. That's often kind of what will come in. So then we want to notice that and bring more clarity. So just kind of noticing from moment to moment, what is the balance between clarity and between relaxation?
Sometimes things seem pretty clear when I'm in meditation, but I've kind of made this decision that the meditation period is not a time for following things up to conclusions and decisions, you know. Because then I think that would be really attachment to my thinking process and forget about my breathing. But it involves for me a kind of faith that this nervous system is a machine that is going to operate on its own inertia. And that if the thing that goes on during meditation is of any use, it'll come back to the thought or whatever will come back, and okay, I can pick it up later. So.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, I guess when I say following it to conclusion, I don't mean like following the story that the mind is telling to conclusion. One of the things that's really helpful is to, like what I was talking about, getting in touch with the pleasant and unpleasant feelings and the aversion. It's often more, I find that feeling the sensations in the body that are associated with that, with those thoughts, that is a more grounding place. And so that's kind of more what I was saying when I was following it to conclusion, was to feel what is the effect. You know, the body is really a good place to start, and to see where those sensations, where, you know, the thoughts of worry, there's always some kind of sensations in the body that are associated with those thoughts. And it's helpful to be in touch with those. That's a lot of what we're avoiding, is not being in touch with those sensations. Thank you. Any other thoughts about worry, planning?
I used up. What am I going to replace all that time with?
Well, I think that's something that we worry about. If we don't worry, what are we going to do? It's kind of, if we don't, if we're not constantly busy, what will we do? Hopefully, there will be a more skillful and beneficial state of mind that that will arise. One of the things is that these things that we're talking about, mind states like worried, these obstacles or hindrances there, they have a, the Pali language that the suttas are written in, it's often translated as covering over. It's a covering that's placed over. And what is it covering over? Well, it's covering over the natural goodness. The Buddha said that consciousness is by its nature pure. It just has these visiting guests. But most of us, we've given the house over to the guests. And they're running rampant and just doing whatever they want. And we have even forgotten that they are guests for the most part. It's become so habitual that we think that they're permanent residents. So just the idea of seeing through these, I guess there's we can have this faith and confidence and interest that there's something that is more beneficial than staying in that state of mind. Anything else that yes.
I'm wondering, I've been at this all that long, and I am one of those people who is very busy in the head. So what you can get inside, I can think about all that you're on the outside and then you're outside, then you're thinking about something else. And so anyone who's been doing it longer could share some kind of description of what is it like to be in the moment, like doing an activity? What is that sensation like?
Well, of course, that's what you've described is kind of the nature of the human mind. We're always looking for the next good thing, So it's if we're doing this, because all of our experiences end, they can't have a lasting satisfaction. So, but we're kind of always, we're still sure that somehow there's going to be this satisfaction, that will come. This one more thing that, we're usually not even quite that clear about it, but that's kind of the way our minds are looking. So, I guess one way you could think about this is if there's been an activity that you really have enjoyed and you've been fully present for, sometimes musicians talk about, being in this space when they play, that, where they're just there and the music is just kind of happening. And you know, it's a place of little or no effort. Or, you know, for some people, like dancing is like that, or maybe gardening. There's maybe some activity that that is like that. So if you have that experience, or if you can imagine what that might be like, that would be a place to, you know, kind of a way to think about that. But with this practice, even the activities that we usually think of as very boring or mundane can have that same kind of fulfillment, where, you know, there is none of this, like kind of what you're describing is this agitation of jumping. You know, sometimes they call it monkey mind, sort of swinging from branch to branch, idea to idea, activity to activity. And so when the mind is calm and balanced, concentrated, focused, then any activity has that fulfillment to it. Making the bed can be engaging, observing, and enjoyable activity. but you know, usually we need to welcome whatever it is. And I guess over time we can develop some faith and confidence that there is this possibility, like the monk said, of eliminating worry or fill in the blank from our consciousness. And what better thing do we have to do with our time anyway? You know, I mean, we all spend a lot of time kind of honing our skills in the world, which is fine, we need to do that as human beings, but how much energy, you know, like we could use a little of our energy to hone the skill of being in the moment and being welcoming what our experience is right now. Yes?
I might have a little thing to add to that. Certainly not anybody that would teach anyone anything. I'm also a beginner, but I had an experience the other day that might illustrate that idea of being in the now. I'm a professional actor, and I was at work on a shoot. So there was a camera, a director, a producer, and lighting people, grips, and other people that were working. And then about seven actors standing in front of the camera under the lights. And the director said, cut, and said, we need to reset the camera before we do the next shot. So there was an unknown period of time that people pretty much just had to stand. We could go for a break, we could sit down, we had to stay where we were. And I had just, in the week prior, gone to a meditation retreat and was very excitedly being in the moment as much as I could. And so when this director said cut, I was standing, another actor was next to me, then there were six other actors kind of in a semicircle. And the only person in the room that was doing anything was the camera operator who was fussing with the camera. Everyone else was standing with their head kind of down, and you could see that their mind was turning. Nobody was saying anything anywhere. Just all their minds. And I was awake, if that makes sense. And I'm not saying this in a judgmental fashion. It's that I was standing there, looking around the room, and seeing and noting that every single person in the room but me, at least that I could see, if that's my perception, was in their mind, spinning. They were all thinking about something. No one was saying anything. The only person that was doing something was the cameraman and me. And I thought, wow, this is what it's like for most of the world, most of the
times people are living up in their heads while if you're awake. And I thought if a light fell from the ceiling right now, it would kill anybody that was standing there. But I would step out of the way at least.
Thank you very much.